Hey, podcasters, we have a great podcast for you today. First, we start with kind of a look at the past. 2008, man, Obama had huge crowds. 2016, Trump had huge crowds. Trump in 2020, apparently huge crowds. You know what's strange? Obama in 2012, not so much. What is it that is fueling Trump? And do the Democrats have anything to stand against that machine? We talk about that. Also, kind of have to take AOC out to the woodshed. I tried to contain myself. She's taken a rake to the face more than once. I think she might have been born in a rake factory. And it started when she took her first few steps. And those rakes have been hitting her in the face until she just doesn't know what truth is anymore. I try to explain it to her on today's program. Plus, an amazing woman story about recovery. David Barton with some facts you've never heard about the American slave trade as we get ready for our museum. And so much more, all on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
So last night, I saw Donald Trump's rally, and I just saw the pictures of Donald Trump's rally, and I thought, wow. Now, I want to take you through, and I'm going to describe these, but if you're a subscriber to The Blaze, this is the time you're going to really appreciate your subscription, because I want you to see these pictures, but I'll describe them if you're just listening to us on radio. Here is a picture that I had no problem finding at all, no problem finding, from 2008. This is Barack Obama during his election. Okay, we all remember this. I think this one is up in I think this is Wisconsin. I could be wrong. I think this is Madison.
A lot of people there. I mean, there's a big turnout.
A lot of people. Mm-hmm. A lot of people. Okay, we remember that, right? Now, if you remember, he had massive crowds in 2008 when he was first elected. When he first was running. Massive crowds. Then what happened? Let me go to picture number two. Now, Google did not help me find any of these. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the Trump rallies, okay, from 2016. And you'll see a lot of people, right? Same kind of picture, is it not, mm-hmm. Stu?
Yeah, gigantic crowds and multiple venues, all over the country.
Multiple venues. Right. And so we know that Obama had them in 2008, and we know that Trump had them in 2016. Now, let's go back and see what happened after 4 years of Obama. How was the health of Obama's coalition? Here's the next picture. Now, you could say that this stadium is, half full. I would say it's half empty. In fact, I would say it's more than half empty, because you'll see they curtained off the other part of the arena. So they're not even used. They're using a quarter of the arena, and only about, what would you say, a quarter of it is full? Half of it is full?
Maybe half, but I think it's less than half, yeah. I mean, okay, and that's so of, now, half of a quarter, we should say.
So we're yes, at an eighth. Half of a quarter. Of an arena, okay? So if you remember, he started doing these things, and he was like, oh boy, we're in trouble. And so he scaled it back. Here's the next photo. Again, you're not going to find these on Google. Oh, look at, we really should stop doing arenas, because this one is more than half empty of a quarter. Next one. So let's scale them back. Let's start doing public parks. I'll be under a gazebo. If you see this picture, there's probably, I'm going to be generous and say 400 people there. But you see on the other side of the gazebo, there's nobody. There's nobody around. It's not like people are, really straining to see him. You're right up next to him in a gazebo. Next one. He started to put a mariachi band out front as people were gathering. This is shortly before President Obama, in his reelection campaign, came into the room, and they had a mariachi band, and even that wouldn't attract anybody. Next. This is Donald Trump last night. This is Donald Trump last night. It looks a little like what Donald Trump had in 2016. Now, you tell me that Joe Biden can attract that. You tell me that Joe Biden has any of that fervor. In fact, I'll go a step further. You have with Joe Biden a situation that I think is going to rapidly decay. I don't know if you've heard the latest on Joe Biden, but from the Washington Post, Joe Biden wistfully recalled on Tuesday an era in which he was able to get along with segregationist senators, even though they didn't agree on much. Dismissing criticism from his party's left-wing flank that he's too conciliatory towards political adversaries, the former vice president told a crowd of about 100 people. Let me say that again. The former vice president told a crowd of about 100 people that one of his strengths was bringing people together. He knows that this makes him old-fashioned in the eyes of Democrats, but he remained adamant that political fellowship of that sort maintained with white supremacists in the 1970s was not just possible in today's climate, but it is the best answer to the forces elevating President Trump. If we can reach a consensus in our system, what happens? He then goes on to talk about how he was, he cited the late Senator James Eastland of Mississippi and Herman Talmadge of Georgia, who are both steadfastly opposed to civil rights and racial integration. I was in a caucus with James Eastland, Biden said, where he was introduced by so-and-so, the Democratic presidential candidate who had been who led his competitors in early polls, blah, 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 blah. He said he impersonated the southern drawl of a Mississippi cotton planter, and he said, "He never called me boy. He always called me son." Okay, well, you're white, Senator. You see, that was a slam. When you called somebody boy, you were usually talking to a black man, and that was a demeaning slam against you. Okay? You're white. Of course he never called you boy. You were white. So this guy that he was holding up and saying, I had a friendship with, I could get along with, and we could work together, he thought that black Americans belonged to an inferior race and warned that integration would cause mongrelization. Biden remarked I've been around so long, I worked with James Eastland, even in the days when I got there. Listen to this. The Democratic Party still had 7 or 8 old-fashioned Democratic segregationalists. You'd get up and argue like the devil with them. But then you'd go down and have lunch or dinner together. Okay, hang on just a second. There is something about, hey, I disagree on tax policy. I disagree on what we should do with the war. There's a huge difference between, oh, by the way, I don't think these people over here are people. I don't know if we, you know, it's not like, hey, I sat with Hitler and I argued all day and all night. But then we had a delightful time and having some, you know, having some Hassenpfeffer. What?
This just goes back to a fundamental truth about Joe Biden running for president, is that he's not good at running for president. Like, he's already tried it.
Not.
He loses every time he tries it. This could go south quickly.
It could. It could. This is, by the way, from the Washington Post, where he's holding up. First of all, he's blowing a hole through the line that it was Republicans that were all the segregationists. No, it was still the Democrats. The Democrats in the 60s were still in with the Klan. Okay, there was no migration over to the Republican Party. That didn't happen. And here he is, qualifying that and saying, yes, that's, you know, they still had, we still had seven or eight, you know, hardline segregationists who didn't even see black people as black people, but I had dinner with them. I could work with them. That was great. Okay, wait a minute. Hang on just a second. What does that say about how you can't talk to Donald Trump? You could have dinner with people who didn't think people were people, but you can't talk to Donald Trump. He's just too extreme. What? Where are you coming from? It is remarkable to me. By the way, another thing the press should be concerned about, the Democrats should be concerned about, the day before he launched his rally, Trump raised a record $24.8 million one day before. So he launches his campaign and he raises a record of $24.8 million. I'd say there's some passion there. I'd say there's some passion. By the way, we're going to go through some of the audio here in just a second. But I thought it was also interesting that Donald Trump is on the campaign trail. He raises record amounts. He has crowds that I have not seen a president ever have in re-election. And I've only seen one other president get it. And that was Barack Obama, who was the first black man in history to be a president. That faded quickly. This isn't fading. How are the Democrats going to be able to do this when they're infighting? And I'm telling you, even if Joe Biden gets the nomination, they're going to be infighting. Look at how far to the center he's trying to run. And even in that article from the Washington Post, it talks about how he is just brushing by the leftists. So he doesn't care what the left is saying, apparently. We know that's not true because he changed his long-term stance on abortion. So he does care about that. But do you really think that the people who support Bernie Sanders are going to be supporting Joe Biden? I don't think so. Because they actually believe in revolution, and they don't see him as a revolutionary. You know who they see him as? Macron in France. He'll be another Macron for anybody who is actually on the left.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and if you like what you hear on the program, you should check out Pat Gray Unleashed. His podcast is available wherever you download your favorite podcast. Let me give you some audio. This is CNN as they cut away from the Trump rally. I can't imagine why they were cutting away. Listen to this.
2016 was not merely another four-year election. This was a defining moment in American history. Ask them right there.
Jesus.
By the way, that is a lot of fake news back there. That's a lot.
All right, we've been watching the president kick off his re-election bid. He's been on stage for about 6 minutes. Within 2 minutes, he did talk about the economy, but within 4 minutes, it was attacks on the media. So he was talking about a bright, rosy future, but then quickly reverted to some of the same themes he's been talking about since he began running 4 years ago today.
Yeah, it really wasn't an attack on the media. Did you notice that, Stu? It was really an attack on CNN.
CNN specifically there, yeah.
Yeah.
And you think, too,
when they were chanting CNN sucks, I don't think that was the media. That was CNN.
And apples being apples, you probably don't want to pull out of coverage, especially when the guy's talking about you, right? Like, that's sort of a banana thing to do, isn't it? To try to hide the fact that you're being attacked? I mean, I honestly don't even understand it. I mean, like, obviously their audience is going to be pleased that Donald Trump does not like them. So why try to pull out and hide that? I don't even understand the reasoning.
I think because you'll notice they dump the video and the audio as soon as the attack stopped. So I think this is backseat driving, giving them a lot more credit than they probably deserve. But if I were making the call, I would be like, hold. The minute he changes subject so he's off of us, go. However, that's giving them CNN superpowers. I just don't think that's what they were scrambling. They were planning on doing. They're like, get back at the desk. You got to go. And he changed subjects as they left.
It must be bizarre for the average CNN viewer, though, because, I mean, you get basically, and this is CNN and MSNBC, but you get basically this constant barrage that everyone is abandoning Trump and he has no supporters anymore. And you brought this up at the beginning. I mean, I don't think there's any question that Donald Trump has massively passionate supporters. The 90% of them plus have not faded from their passion for Donald Trump. The question is, does he have a large enough group of passionate people to win an election? And obviously that's going to be what the answer that, you know, we're going to get that in 18 months. But I mean, the idea that you're going to say that, like, he doesn't have these passionate supporters and that they don't care it's an asinine argument. I mean, that's his whole thing.
The question is, will it influence people? And I think it will. You know, Don Imus taught me something a long time ago. He said, if you don't have 30% of the audience that hates you, the available audience that hates you, you're not doing anything. You're not being different enough. You're not, you know, you 30% of the audience is what provides fuel for the other 70%. And he didn't mean it like go make people pissed off, et cetera, et cetera. He was just like, you're not saying anything if you don't have, you know, at least, you know, some people that really dislike you. So Donald Trump, he's got about 30% of the people who really don't like him. Now, he's also got about 30% of the people who love him. That was Don's other piece of advice. Only if you have that polarization, only if you have that real people who are just like, this guy really hacks me off, will you have the passion of the audience, maybe 30%, that will say, I love this guy. And it's the effect of the I love this guy that will sway the rest of the audience. Now, here's the problem with Donald Trump. Donald Trump has the media, and the media will expand all of the hatred of Donald Trump. They're going to be pushing that out. So as his 30% that love him create this atmosphere of wow, there's something exciting going on over here, which is important. The same time, the media is going to be tearing it apart and saying, no, look at all the people that hate him. Well, I got news for you. The media is not who they were in 2016. Who's watching CNN? Literally, who?
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
You know, I didn't have a lot to say on Father's Day, and I was going to, and then I didn't. As a dad, I am working so hard to be a good dad, and I fail so often. But I'm trying to be a better man every day. If you're a longtime listener to this program, you know that my dad and I didn't have a close relationship when I was growing up. It was a very complicated family. It was a mess. And then my dad and I got very close, and he was my hero. In my 30s and early 40s, he was my hero. And then we had to confront abuse. And my dad was revealed to me to be a monster. I mean, a monster. And I've never talked about it, and I will someday, but I've had a very, very difficult time in the last few years dealing with this. And And I thought my family was a shipwreck. We had a family therapist. We all went through therapy for this recently, and she said, "I've never seen a shipwreck of a family like this before. Just an on the rock shipwreck." And there's always somebody who can show you a bigger shipwreck. And I picked up a book recently. It's called Climbing Out of the Wreck. And I picked it up, and it's one of those books that it doesn't take too long to read, and you start to pick it up, and you are just, you're amazed by the story, and you don't put the book down until you're finished. And it's also one of those books that you read, and you're like, okay, please have a happy ending. And it does. It is a very brave tale, told by somebody who is under pseudonym Christine Stein, and she joins us now. Hello, Christine. How are you?
Hi, Glenn. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
I was really deeply moved by your story and the courage that it took to be who you are today. Can you just give the audience a little brush of your childhood?
Well, I want to start, and I want to say I'm so sorry that you had to go through a hard childhood. I know what that's all about. My father was a sexual predator, and my mother was an alcoholic drug user. So you can just imagine what that was like for children to go through. It would be even hard for an adult to take it all in, but it was a nightmare, you know. But we did have times that we had love in our family. I did get that at times, but then there were these other times that no child should have to ever go through. Go ahead.
Your father was sexually abusive to your sisters, and it even went to court, and your mother testified against your sister, even though she knew it was true.
Yes. You know, the sad thing about this, Glenn, there is, that's not just like that has just happened, that it happens a lot. There's a lot of mothers that were the husband, or the boyfriend that has sexually abused their child. But my mother did that. And I think my mother was such a lost soul in so many ways. But my mother, her childhood was, my grandfather had raped her and all her sisters, and he was an alcoholic, raging alcoholic. So, there's no excuse for her behavior at all. But when I was at a point in my life that I stood back and I said, who are these people that have abused me so much and my siblings, I started looking into really what they came from. And my mother came out of a horrible situation. And on the other hand, my father was educated, had loving parents, and it just didn't make any sense. You know, they couldn't really wrap their heads around, later on finding out what he was up to. So, you can kind of say some people are just born evil, and that's the only way I can describe that. I think my mother's situation is what you're taught, and she passed it, on. She never got therapy to deal with it. And then she went on when I was about 14 years old, she was taken away. She lost her mind, and I didn't see her for almost a year, but I would see her off and on, but she didn't come back to the house. And she was a different person, because there was times that my mom could really be wonderful, and then there was times with the alcohol and her depression and the drugs. One time I watched my mother try to kill herself in the bathroom when I was about 7 years old, and nobody should have to see their mother try to do something like that. It was pretty devastating. But she twice in her life she tried to kill herself, and it was it's very painful now because I love my mother. I hold on to the good parts of my mom. But these other things I want people to understand, I guess people like us, that, when we go through something that we are scarred and we are traumatized and, we are still fighting those scars, and they kind of open up at times.
Christine, Because I went through this with my dad, and my father was raped when he was young and had a horrible, horrible childhood. And so I attached compassion, and I loved my dad. And I loved my dad that he was working to conquer it. And at one point in his life, he just gave up. And it was about the time he was about 70, 75 years old. He just gave up, and he became an absolute monster. And I'm struggling. You know, it was with Tony Robbins, and he reminded me of a lot of the good stuff my father taught me. And because I had forgotten some of those things, or I had dismissed those things, because I just took my dad's teachings and everything and threw it out the window. And I just rejected everything, as he said, was a lie. And I'm starting to put those things in order again. But that's really difficult. Have you?
It is. I'll just break it down. I went to visit my mother, and my dad was there. And this is, you know, I'm about 22, 23 at this time. I go in. I have a son at this point, and he's a little boy. And I go in there, and I could tell my father was ready to attack me psychologically. I just knew it was going to happen. And he started attacking me and then asking me sexual questions and saying, who are you? What are you? And something took over. And I looked at him and I said, I know I'm not you. I never will be you. And, you know, what you taught me is not to be you. Within, you know, like I'd say less than 10 minutes, I got up. I walked out of the house with my son. I went to the car. And I, you know, I was crying because it's pretty emotional when you have a parent attacking you like that, which I had it all my life. It was years of this. My son looked at me and he was like, I know who you are, Mommy. I love you. I think you're wonderful. And I thought to myself, being in that nightmare of that man that have abused me pretty much all my life. And then I go within 10 minutes to something that loves me and shows me I can do the right thing and live a great life. It really psychologically showed me I don't have to put up with that person. I'm so much more than what this person would make me feel like garbage, that I was able to go on to give life to somebody that loves me and adores me. And it really pulled me through it. So it's kind of like those little moments in life that kind of tell you, wow, because it is. And I guess, you know, from your situation, you kind of slide back at times and you feel bad about yourself. You kind of reflect on what's happened to you. Or sometimes you react to things you don't even realize it was something from your childhood. And it doesn't mean that we're not good people. I think, you know, in my life, I'm not cruel to people. I've actually lived a life of trying to save things, animals and people, because it kind of feels like I'm saving myself at times. So that urgency, I'm a little addicted to it because I want to fix it as fast as I can.
Right.
Because I guess somebody, you know, I wish that somebody could come and help me. I remember the police were always in and out of our homes because the neighbor, you know, the neighbors would call. And I remember one time a police officer came up to me, and I was about 7 or 8 years old, and my sister was with me. And it was all night. My mother was wasted and screaming. My father had came in, you know, from God only knows where. So the fight was going on. And at one point, my mom picked up a steak knife. My mom would, in her rage, as she would pick up knives and threaten, you know, my father or us kids screaming at us with them. That the officer came up to me and he bent down and he was like, are you okay, little girl? And the whole time I wanted to say, please take me with you. Just take me out of here. I'm so tired. But I said, oh, I'm fine. And people need to understand children, why they do that is because we're scared to leave everything that we know, even though it might be a nightmare. It's like you want out of it, but then you realize I'll be taken, you know, from this home that I know, my siblings and my parents can be okay at times, and you hold on to those things, even though you're being abused.
Christine, I would like to figure out a way, because I know you're keeping your identity, because there's still problems with the family and everything else, and I completely relate. I would love to find a way to where we could keep your identity, and I could sit down with a podcast and talk to you, because there's there's a lot of wisdom in your book. And the good thing is we've just talked about the bad things. There is a way out. You did climb out of this wreck, and not all of your siblings have, and I understand. Yeah. I mean, it causes real problems with your siblings, and it's just, you know, the walking on eggshells doesn't ever seem to end.
Like one of my sisters, you know, she's homeless. She became a drug addict. She was a beautiful young girl. And the last time I saw her was a few years ago. I mean, I hate to say it this way, but, you know, teeth were missing out of her. She had holes in her face. And I could barely really communicate with her. All she wanted was money to get more drugs. And I just had to stop the relationship. But she's very a mean, violent kind of person. And she chose, you know, and my other siblings, the difference between myself and now two of my other sisters, we want a good life and we want to give it to our children. And we, you know, I realize if I stay a victim and angry, I'm just going to pass that on to my child. And this is never going to stop. And I ended up pregnant in my early 20s. And I was in a situation, you know, I had no business because still I was working through all these issues and going through a lot. My environment wasn't the greatest. And I remember I went to the doctor thinking I was sick, and he said, "Christine, you're pregnant." And I was like, "Oh, no, no, no," because in my family, abortions were the norm. You know, I took several of my sisters there. My mother had them. This was just my environment. But something really hit me hard, and I sat in my car and I cried. Now, religion and God wasn't a big thing in my family either. Actually, my father would put people that believed in religion down, saying that they were weak people when he actually was, you know, the sick person. But I started to pray. Even though I didn't really know how to pray, I just started saying, if there's a God, I need guidance, I need help because I'm scared. And I'm not here to tell people what to do. I'm not at all, but I'm just telling my story. And something came over me, and it became super clear. And I just knew I can have this baby. I can work hard. I will help this baby. This baby will never have, you know, things that happened to me happen to it. And my son is 33 now, and he's a doctor, and he's in situations where he helps save lives, and he became a scientist as well, and he studies cancer and AIDS work on, go ahead.
Christine, I would love to have you on a podcast because you're just beginning to tell the great part of the story. I urge you to pick up the book. It is Climbing Out of the Wreck, Christine Stein. It's a tough childhood. You think you have somebody, your kids or anybody says, I've got it so tough. Give them this book. And then it shows how to climb out of the wreck. It's a fantastic book. It's Climbing Out of the Wreck by Christine Stein. Hope to talk to you again, Christine. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
This is the Glenn Beck Program, and we're joined by David Barton. And David, you are very politically active, and you see polls. Tell me what the things that the president needs to stand on to be able to win.
I think there's two issues that he has opportunity to make a lot of ground on. One actually is socialism. Polling we've seen on socialism is very interesting for where it breaks demographically. You have about 41% of Americans who support socialism. You have 69% of millennials and 75% of college students. So the younger the crowd, the more they support socialism. But what's interesting is George Barna. I love Barna because he never really stops with just a question on a poll. He keeps asking questions, find out if you know what you're talking about. So he found that 41% of Americans supported socialism, and so he asked an additional 40-plus questions about socialism, and he just asked what it was. He said, do you support greater government regulations? Do you support greater government ownership of private business, et cetera? And it's all socialism. I mean, he found at the end only 2% actually supported socialism once they knew what it was. They just didn't have a clue. So we found that, you know, surface polling, the two, when you ask people what is socialism, the two biggest answers were that it dealt with social media or that it dealt with sharing. And who's against sharing? Right. So I'm for socialism.
Yeah.
So when you actually get into what it is, and so I think the president has a big opportunity to really gain ground if education about socialism can go as part of what he's doing. If he'll keep talking about it for the next several months and people chime in and say, do you understand what socialism is? Do you understand what the free market, what you lose? I think he has a big ground there. I think the other big ground he has is actually what he raised last night on abortion, how extreme it is. He talked about Virginia, et cetera. We literally have seen that since Virginia, Governor Northam said what he said, since Cuomo did what he did in New York, other states have joined. We've seen that the pro-life position among Democrats has increased 17%, which that's just massive. Among young people, there was a 40-point switch because they didn't really think about what abortion was in late term. Mm-hmm. And so somewhere between 70 and 80% of the nation opposes last trimester abortions, much less infanticide. So that's another issue that if he will stay on that and people talk about what this actually is. And by the way, Cuomo, after he passed that bill in New York, his numbers plummeted to the lowest they've been in his entire term after he did that essentially an infanticide bill in New York. So I think those are two big opportunities he has.
So I just got word that we have coming in for our museum. We have some survivors, the mother of one of the big survivors of the Boko Haram nightmare with Muslims coming in and just taking these kids, you know, and Michelle Obama tweeting, you know, we want our girls back. Well, we got some of them and we have one of the mothers coming in from Nigeria to talk about that. We have a couple of people that are going to be docents at this museum because it's not our usual museum.
That's right. Yeah, this museum.
Can you explain a little bit? Go ahead.
This really, how do we say this? There's so much we learn about history that is history, but history really is today. I mean, we will look at the African slave trade, 350 years, 12.7 million Africans brought out of Africa into slavery in 350 years. Okay. But today there are 40 million in slavery today. That's more than 350 years of the African slave trade. What are we doing about it today? And so when you look,
can't really denigrate our founding fathers and say, oh, they didn't do enough, when the problem is much worse and we're not even looking at it.
That's right.
David, there's also, we're going to clear up some things, and I think we're going to make a few people mad with some of the stats, but they are official stats. For instance, the two that we keep coming back to, one, the slave trade in America was horrible.
That's
horrible.
Right. That's right.
But out of all those that were enslaved and brought across the ocean, we were only 4% of the receivers.
Yeah, when you,
the number one was Brazil.
Brazil was 46% of all those carried out of Africa went to Brazil. 26% went to Great Britain. 10% went to Jamaica. You keep going down the list. We're one of the smallest on the list, which doesn't excuse what we had. But America, the English colonies in America, 3.3%. Denmark had less than that. So, but we're at the bottom, and that's still way too many. Shouldn't have happened. But there's no excuse. But what we also point out is there has never been any people in history that, number one, did not own slaves, and number two, were not themselves slaves at some time. And so the American academic thing of slavery is absolutely white on black and it's white privilege and et cetera. Statistically, that doesn't hold up. I mean, quite frankly, you had in that same period, Muslims captured 1.25 million slaves and most of them Christian slaves. They were doing religious slavery. We know that at the time of the Civil War in South Carolina, 43% of free blacks in South Carolina owned black slaves. And we know that with the Indian tribes at the time of the Civil War, one out of every eight among the five major Indian tribes, they were black slaves. Indians were big owners of slaves. As a matter of fact, when the 13th Amendment was passed, it didn't apply to the Indian nation. And so the Indian nations had slavery much longer than we had it in the 13th Amendment.
And you never hear any of this. You never hear any of it. And again, We'll only get in trouble for those who think we're trying to excuse it. And we're not.
We're not.
Just trying to give perspective and to show you that history repeats itself. And without a true balanced look at history, you can't do anything. You're just going to be trapped in the past. History is being made right now, today. David, how did it end in Brazil? How come somebody who takes 46%, we only take 4%? Do they struggle with their slave heritage?
Oh, no, they don't cover that in history. But Brazil still is a very high country for a high number of slaves today. One of the things that we have as you come into the museum is a map showing the dispersion of slaves at 12.7 million to all the nations back then. Kind of shows a hot spot, which were the hot nations. Well, there's a map today for the 40 million, and you look at the hot spots, and Brazil is still a hot spot. So it's not like that they have gotten over this. This is still a very current thing all across Africa. They're the same places that were culprits 300 years ago are still culprits today, quite frankly.
It's also interesting, and this is just this. You don't even leave the lobby or the first part of the. I think we have it broken up in 9 sections. We're only covering the stuff that's in section 1.
Yeah, that's
You'll
right.
Be in there for like
that's
10
right.
minutes. I mean, that's this right. is section 1. The fact that, you know, we fought a civil war. We had the 13th Amendment, which will be down in our studios. You'll be able to see the actual document, and I think the Juneteenth document as well, isn't it?
Yeah, Juneteenth is when the announcement reached Texas, which was like a year and a half later that the 13th Amendment was signed. So it was the Emancipation Proclamation. But we actually have the pen that Lincoln used to sign the 13th Amendment right there with the 13th Amendment. So it's really some amazing stuff.
It's really going to be cool.
Once in a lifetime kind of opportunity to see some cool stuff.
Yeah. And we, as we're doing this, you know, we look at, again, our founders and we say, you know, they were horrible. Well, Mexico actually abolished slavery before we did. Do you know the dates, David?
I don't remember the dates. Yeah, technically, on paper, they abolished slavery. It didn't really work out that way because they had a 99-year kind of exception. Oh, by the way, if you own slaves, you can hold them up to 99 more years. But we're abolishing slavery,
right.
But you get to keep your slaves for 99
right.
years.
And
okay,
isn't that pretty much what we get yelled at for with our founders when they made the compromise in the Constitution and said, look, we're going to phase out this part and we'll come back to it later. I mean, at least they didn't say, and 100 years later, then it's going to stop.
Well,
I mean, they were hoping that it would stop earlier.
Their abolition of the slave trade, that they said in 1787, we want this ended by 1808. That's the earliest of any nation. I mean, abolishing slave trade, 1808, we're first on that. We're kind of second in actually abolishing slavery. We are the only nation in the history of the world where the whites fought whites and ended slavery for blacks. I mean, we've got so many firsts that don't get talked about, but what happened even with the founding fathers and the slave trade, the problem we have with academics today is that there is a northern view of slavery where that, for example, in Massachusetts, there never was a time when blacks could not vote. You have a middle view of slavery in the middle colonies, and you have a southern view, which is where the plantation slavery was, all the abominations.
Mm-hmm.
And all we cover is the southern view of slavery. We don't cover the middle colony view or the northern colony view. And so we really do not teach an accurate view of history on what happened with race. And, you know, we're going to hope to do that in the museum. Not hope to. We're doing that in the museum because we want truth. Truth is the objective we have.
Right. And again, it's not to diminish
that's right.
This. And the whole point of the museum we haven't even gotten to yet. The whole point of the museum is if you hate it so much, why don't we all work together to stop it from happening today?
Mm-hmm.
And there's some stunning things that I'm shocked that we have and I think are this is not for your small kids. This is not for your small kids. Hopefully it will be another drop in the bucket to get people to act. Mercury1.org is where you can get the tickets. David does a tour. I'll do tours. Stu even does a tour, which I don't know what you're going to learn on that.
Very little, but it'll be fun.
yeah, but it'll be fun. It's it is really something that we have worked very hard, and we have sweat blood over this one, because we know how dangerous this is. We know in this politically correct environment, to tell the facts that you've never heard, never heard, put it into perspective and not dwell on that, but say, look, this is the pattern that happened then. Look at the pattern. It's happening again now. And it doesn't have anything to do with race. Let's work together. That's not a popular thing. But we invite you to come, and you can get your tickets at mercury1.org. It opens up the 27th of June, and it goes through the 7th of July. Make sure you join us, mercury1.org. That's mercury1.org. Get your tickets now. We're 10 days away from the opening. David, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.